to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. It's been a busy couple of weeks for announcements in the Alberta research community. The Biodiversity Challenge Grant Program, sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, celebrates its 9 years of success. They've just awarded their 200th grad student with their $2 millionth dollar, all for the betterment of our plants and animals. And the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research will fund 43 researchers in Calgary and Edmonton to work more miracles for human health, and that's to the tune of $27 million. And ICOR, the Alberta Informatics Circle for Research Excellence, has worked out a partnership with the University of Alberta and NINT to fund a research chair with the National Institute for Nanotechnology. In the next half hour, you'll hear from the people at the heart of these stories on Innovation Alberta. What you're listening to is the raspy call of a wood frog looking for a mate. The wood frog is just one of the thousands of species that inhabit Alberta's ecosystems. And ensuring that our future generations will enjoy the call of the wood frog is one reason why the Alberta Conservation Association established the Biodiversity Challenge Grants Program for university graduate students. I recently caught up with Steve Hull, the ACA's managing director, at a celebration marking 9 years of success for conservation research in Alberta.
Well, actually, it is, because it's a financial milestone. We've been funding or the money behind the biodiversity grant program for about 9 years now, and we've actually hit 200 students and the $2 millionth dollar. So, pretty major event to hit on something like that on an ongoing program.
That's a lot of money to be giving away. Why do you do it?
One of the things that we look at is scientific credibility. We're a knowledge broker, really, is what we do. And being able to invest in the future and the science practitioners that are going to be bringing the science to the biodiversity whole conservation effort in the next few years is really a good investment in the future for Alberta.
What do you see as being the state of biodiversity in Alberta at this time?
Under duress from all kinds of, whether it's industry or just straight the number of people moving into the province. And it just needs to be something that has to be very carefully managed throughout the next generations.
How is some of this research being used that you've helped fund?
Primarily a lot of the research we use, the province, the provincial government, are the managers of the resource. Our role to play with them in partnership is to supply good, scientifically credible knowledge so that good resource management decisions can be made.
Where does the money come from?
Our basic source of funding right now is the levy that's on from the hunters and anglers. Everybody that buys a hunting, fishing license, or wind card in Alberta contributes to our funding, and we manage to leverage that through partnerships with industry and a lot of other groups in the conservation world.
Sounds like it's good value for the money.
I think so.
Thank you very much.
Right, Cheryl. Thanks.
That was Steve Hull, Managing Director for the Alberta Conservation Association. The man coordinating the Biodiversity Challenge Grants Program is Dr. Bill Samuel, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta, and a scientist that many people recognize from his work on winter ticks that parasitize moose.
We support research by graduate students and young postdoctoral fellows in the area of conservation biology, ecology, fish and wildlife biology. And one of the mandates of the program is that these students, they can be from any university anywhere, but they have to do their research in Alberta. So this is a program to better the understanding of the flora and fauna of this great province in which we live.
When you look back over the 9 years of this Biodiversity Challenge program, what are some of the things that you found out that perhaps we wouldn't have known if we hadn't had this program?
Well, that's a good question, and the students learn unique things as we go. I'm reminded of one of our recipients who was trying to find out how boreal chickadees overwinter in cold weather, and we thought they huddled in cavities of trees to keep warm, and indeed they do, but she put little tiny radios on these things, and she learned that when she went out at minus 40, she held the antenna up on her receiver looking for these birds up in the trees, and lo and behold, they were making small holes in the snow, and they were getting beneath the snow layer to stay warm. So, you know, young people with inquisitive minds always learn some really interesting things.
What's happened to some of the students who have gone through this program and received money from the Biodiversity Challenge program?
We've actually tracked some of our graduates because one of the mandates of this program, in addition to learning more about our fish and wildlife and the habitat in which they live, is that we want to create some really, really good professional conservation biologists to carry on with the future of monitoring what happens to our fish and wildlife and its habitat in this province. So one of our hopes is that these young people are encouraged enough by their support that they remain in the province when they're done. And indeed, it looks like two-thirds to three-quarters of our young people do remain to carry on and have a career in Alberta. I'm not saying that the program has everything to do with this, but I know that when you pat a young person on the back and say, here, you have competed for this money and what you're proposing to do is really good for Alberta and its fish and wildlife, these students are on cloud nine, and they appreciate this. And that thought in the back of their mind that we've endorsed their work by providing them with research money, that stays with them forever. And we think it influences them to stay and work in Alberta.
Who is the 200th student who's receiving the $2 millionth dollar?
Right. Our 200th supported research program is that of a master's student at the University of Alberta, a young lady named Kirsten Norris. And Kirsten is proposed and will be beginning her master's work this summer to study the effect of northern pike preying upon young tadpole northern frogs. So a pretty important project.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you. Glad you're here.
That was Dr. Bill Samuel, professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta and coordinator of the Biological Challenge Grants Program. As Bill mentioned, the graduate student honored as the 200th recipient of the $2 millionth is Kirsten Norris. Her grant of $16,100 from the Alberta Conservation Association will be put to work this spring.
My project is going to look at the interactions between northern pike and wood frog tadpoles in boreal ponds. I'm going to be working out just about an hour and a half north of Edmonton and stocking some ponds with pike and seeing how they affect the wood frog tadpoles that are coming off the ponds in the spring.
Where are you doing that?
It's generally known that fish have a negative impact on tadpoles in general, and I'm hoping that this will contribute to just sort of the knowledge about amphibians and maybe contribute to the conservation of amphibians in conjunction with the stocking of pike in Alberta. And maybe it can be extended to other amphibians that are in more danger than the wood frogs.
How is it that you're going to do your study?
I've got three ponds, six ponds, and I'm going to stock them with adult pike, juvenile pike, and no pike. And I'm also going to stock them with equal numbers of tadpoles. And then we're going to measure the tadpoles, their activity, their growth, measure the metamorphs that come off the pond, figure out how soon they come off, if they're coming off early, if they're coming off late. And we can also flush the stomachs of the pike without killing them and see what they're actually eating. So see if they're eating these guys or if they're just sort of scaring them.
What knowledge are you building on?
We have data from 1995 that show that when pike numbers are low due to winter kill or something like that, that the number of amphibians that are coming off the ponds is quite high. And so we kind of have a general idea of what's going to happen in these ponds, but we're not sure of the mechanism. So are the pike eating these guys or are they just interfering with their foraging? And also something that we can apply to the natural sites in Alberta. So the results from this we can hopefully apply to ponds that either are fishless and are listed as being stocked with pike, or ponds that we know have good amphibian populations and pike in them, and see how those are working together.
Does this have anything to do with the timing of when pike themselves go up to spawn? Because they'll quite often go into the grassy areas.
Yeah, it does have a lot to do with that. Pike, when they spawn in very early spring, as soon as the ice comes off the pond. And then after that, they eat. They just eat whatever they can find. And so the wood frogs lay their eggs also early spring as soon as eggs come off the pond. And so the time the pike are feeding is pretty much the same time that the tadpoles are coming off of the eggs. So there probably is a high correlation of that, just looking to see what actually happens there.
Why wood frogs and not something else?
Wood frogs are not currently endangered, so they're pretty easy to work with. They're pretty easy to find. They're found all the way across the prairie provinces. And their eggs are laid in clumps, and so it's pretty easy to find their eggs. And they're also pretty easy to rear, eggs to tadpole stage. And so they're just a good organism to work with, and we don't have to worry about them being endangered or having an impact on their population at all.
What did it mean to you getting this Biodiversity Challenge grant?
It's really exciting. It means that I will be able to continue with my project with thorough investigation, whereas before I might not have been able, might have had to cut back in some areas. But now I can go through with everything that I was hoping to, both with the ponds and the stocking, and I can also continue the natural investigations that have been going on since 1995 on the natural lakes. It also means that if I need help, I can ask for help in the form of a field assistant or two and something like that. So it's really, really exciting, and I'm very, very happy to have been awarded it.
Congratulations and good luck with your project.
Thanks very much.
That was Kirsten Norris, a master's student at the University of Alberta, whose research is funded through the Alberta Conservation Association's Biodiversity Challenge Grants Program. I also spoke with Dr. Bill Samuel and the ACA's Steve Hull. The Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research has just announced another round of funding to help 43 Alberta scientists continue their groundbreaking work at the University of Calgary and the University of Alberta. One of those fellows is Dr. Alan Willman, a medical researcher who hails from a background in physics and has already made his mark in the world of magnetic resonance imaging. He's working with the advanced MRI systems at the University of Alberta Hospital.
When I was in UBC, a professor gave a talk and he showed an image of his head. And I thought, wow, this is great. I want to do this. And that was it. So he had an image from one of the first MRI machines and got excited about it.
Now, is that why you also took an image of your brain and showed it to everyone today?
I guess partly taking my own brain is to remind everyone that MRI is a very safe technology. I mean, as long as you're screened appropriately so you don't have anything magnetic in your body that could get pulled, it's very safe. And that's just to emphasize that it's safe technology using magnetic fields and radio waves.
What is it that you're working on? What's your area?
So my area is applying MRI to blood vessel imaging. And basically, as a physicist, trying to design new techniques and new ways to use MRI. MRI is a lot more complicated than, say, typical X-ray imaging. There's a lot you can do with it that requires quite a lot of insight and physics and engineering knowledge. So I'm looking at that knowledge and figuring out ways to do MRI in a different manner.
How have you applied it so far? Because you've invented a new technique that is actually used all around the world.
Right. So in the past, one of the techniques for an area called contrast-enhanced MRI developed a way of acquiring data in a manner where you can do high-resolution images and see the arteries and not see the veins, which was quite a problem with this technique. So it's basically hard to explain the details of it all, but basically it's been possible to use the physics and pull things out of it that people hadn't seen before, and these have been applicable to the way the scans should be done.
You've just received a new round of funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. What are you going to apply it to?
I'm going to apply it to the same area, to blood vessel imaging, but in particular in our facility we have two MRIs that are double and triple strength MRIs compared to a typical MRI scanner. And we're going to look at how we can use these higher field systems to get even better quality and perhaps make better diagnosis with MRI by looking at everything that's involved in these higher field systems.
What would be the concerns with that? Why do we have to go to those lengths?
When MRI first got started in the early 80s, the magnetic fields were about 0.1 Tesla. Tesla is a unit of magnetic field. Nowadays, typical ones are 1.5 Tesla, so 15 times stronger. recently, three Tesla ones have become used clinically around the world. So it's been a constant march of increasing field strength. And leading that march has to be physicists and engineers who understand how these systems work and develop the techniques. So we're sort of pushing forward this ever-going evolution to higher magnetic field. The higher the field, normally, the better images you can get, because you get much more signal out from the MRI experiment when you go to higher fields.
Do we know what the limits are at this point? Would we get to a point where it's just not healthy for a person?
Yeah, I think we will eventually get to a point where the fields become too strong, and effects like our ears will feel a little bit dizzy from the magnetic field pulling on the semicircular canals. I think that's the right word. But at present, there's a field of 8 Tesla used right now in some places in the world. At some point, we'll reach a point where there's no more benefit, and we certainly will reach that. We don't know if we're there yet, but in essence, the march of field will probably be stopped by there being no clinical value of going to higher field as opposed to the safety issue.
What makes your work different than what's going on elsewhere?
I guess the main difference is that we have access to these higher field MRI systems. The triple strength one is the highest field in Canada. There are other blood vessel researchers in Canada using MRI, probably about perhaps 5 or 6 of us. So we're similar in many ways, but I have access to higher field MRI systems to sort of push the field a little bit further.
Is that what brought you to Alberta?
No, in fact, these are quite new systems that were funded by the Canadian Foundation of Innovation, Alberta Heritage, University of Alberta Hospital Foundation, and a number of other people. When I first came, we had a double-strength MRI, and that was all we had. So we've come a long way since then.
How is it that we ended up with all that?
Well, if we go back to the start, in 1985, HFMR, Alberta Heritage Foundation, funded the first MRI system in Western Canada, and that was used for clinical research, but also for patient studies. And we've sort of evolved since then. So the Heritage Foundation has played a big role in attracting the scientists and helping fund the new facility as well.
What are the challenges that you face in doing your research? Is there something that's a real problem for you?
I guess the problem is always trying to come up with new ideas and new ways of doing things. And as the technology gets older and more established, there's less and less room for innovation. So that's a technical challenge and an intellectual challenge. And the second challenge can sometimes be a financial one. To do our research, we have to get research grants from outside of the province, typically. And it's an ever-ongoing battle to try and get these research grants when success rates can be as low as, say, 20%. So that's an ongoing stressor.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
That was Dr. Alan Willman, a researcher in magnetic resonance imaging technology and an assistant professor at the University of Alberta. His work is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. The tiny world of nanotechnology got a boost this month to the tune of $10 million. This will fund a new ICOR Chair of Nanoscale Information and Communication Technologies at the University of Alberta and the National Institute for Nanotechnology in Edmonton. The scientist taking up this research chair is Dr. Robert Wilco. He has been working at the Stacey Institute in Ottawa and is considered among the top 5 researchers in the world in his field.
Scanning tunneling microscopy is a new kind of microscope. It's unlike any other microscope in that it doesn't use any lenses, it doesn't use light. It's actually a lot like a record player, surprisingly. It involves scanning a very fine probe around on a surface and just tracing out the topography as you might trace your finger over the knuckles on your hand. Except it does that with an exquisitely sharp probe, so sharp it has a single atom on the end. And that probe is able to feel the contours of the surface on a similarly fine scale, down to the atomic level. And so we get amazing pictures that reveal the finest structure of matter.
How can that be applied?
Well, even today, semiconductor technology is close to relying on properties of matter that depend on atomic scale structure being highly defined. And in the future, we hope to take that a step further, where single atoms or very small groups of atoms and molecules will be the functional parts of new devices.
We're here today at a reception for you in Government House at Edmonton, a harp in the background, and all kinds of important people. You're now being appointed to the ICOR chair, which will be associated with the Nanotechnology Institute here in Edmonton. What does that mean for you and your research?
Well, it's a tremendous opportunity, a great honor. It brings almost incomparable resources to what I think needs to be done. It makes it possible to do virtually anything we imagine. We will be as well supported as any group in the world in this area. It's really a tremendous opportunity.
What are you going to work on?
Well, a whole range of projects, all focusing in on somehow marrying organic matter, stuff like plants and the stuff that plants and animals are made of, with the inorganic world, such as found in silicon chips or silicon computers. And we think that by combining these things, we'll be able to make a new range of medical diagnostic tools, for example, or new technologies that wouldn't be possible with traditional methods alone.
I had an opportunity to hear you speak when you were out here in the fall, and even today you managed to bring up a few of your personal concerns. And I'd have to say that what strikes me about you is that you're the conscience, in a sense, behind nanotechnology or some of the new areas that we're going into. Why is that? What is your concern?
Oh, I guess I feel a strong obligation to the public. They provide a tremendous amount of money to allow me to do what I do. So I feel obligated to respect the public who pays for what we do. And I think they're entitled to know what we do and to raise questions and to even guide what we do. So I think it's just the decent way to behave.
Thank you very much, and good luck with your research here.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was Dr. Robert Wilco, newly appointed to the ICOR Chair in Nanoscale Information and Communication Technologies at the National Institute for Nanotechnology in Edmonton. In coming to Edmonton, Robert will be joining his friend and colleague, Dr. Dan Wehner, Acting Director General for the National Institute for Nanotechnology.
Well, it means a lot on many levels. At the level of, I'll say, a manager, he is clearly in the top five people in his area in the world, and the fact that we can get him here when he literally could go anywhere in the world is just a tremendous accomplishment that's really attributed to this partnership between the NRC, the University of Alberta, and ICOR.
How are you going to use him? What areas are you going to work in?
Well, he's actually going to be partitioning himself halfway between the university and the NRC and NINT. Within NINT, he's going to build and lead a group in an area that we call molecular scale devices, which is, if you remember what he was talking about, is actually learning how to take individual molecules and turn them eventually into things that either sense other molecules or can do computation.
Well, he's certainly a leader in this area, isn't he? He's actually discovered how some of these things work.
That's right. He has a very long and distinguished career for someone who's actually reasonably young.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
That was Dr. Dan Wehner, Acting Director General for the National Institute for Nanotechnology. Dr. Brian Unger is a professor of computing science at the University of Calgary and the president of ICOR, the group responsible for establishing the new chair.
Well, nanotechnology is sort of at the merger of chemistry and biology and mechanical engineering and physics. And the potential in this field is both frightening and mystical and exciting. So all kinds of projections have been made, and I think we're looking at longer term. We're looking at 5, 10, 15, 20 years before we see some of the things that are being talked about coming to reality. But it is a fundamental area that we need to be involved in.
Now, you've managed to attract Robert Wilco from Ottawa to Alberta to work and hold this chair. What does that mean to you? Why have you gone after him?
Well, I think he is one of the two or three top people in Canada in this field. And I think that Bob Wilco is a kind of person who brings a breadth of skills, not just technical. He's a great scientist, but he also has personal skills that are going to enable him to, I believe, build a real organization at the U of A in nanotechnology. So it's attracting other people and building a major research program that has benefits for all of Alberta.
What is it that ICOR looks at?
ICOR is focused on bringing exceptional people into Alberta, like Robert Wilco, who make a real difference, who attract junior people, attract graduate students. My personal real objective in this that somewhat echoes what Bob Church said today is if we're 1% of the North American community, if you have a child or a grandchild who's brilliant, where are they going to go to work? Where's their career going to be? The chances of it being in our community, the Alberta community, are very, very small. So we lose our brightest and most talented people. They go to some of the other centers in the world. I think what we're doing, in my personal view, is we're creating greater opportunities for our children and grandchildren, and particularly our most talented.
Where does nanotechnology fit in with informatics?
Nanotechnology basically leverages a whole range of things. It's an enabling technology, very much like ICT is, like informatics is. Informatics supports tourism, supports, you know, you name any field where they're all, what you're using right now, you know, this is all based on informatics, how you're recording my voice. Nanotechnology is a similar sort of thing. It's as broad or even broader than informatics. And there are many applications of nanotechnology to informatics, as well as vice versa. So they're closely tied. If you look at molecules like Wilco was talking about earlier, DNA, RNA, these kinds of molecules are basically, what we understand about them is because of our understanding of informatics. They're encoding how to construct a body. An organism, a living organism.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Brian Unger, president of ICOR, the Alberta Informatics Circle for Research Excellence. I also spoke with Dr. Dan Wehner of the National Institute for Nanotechnology and Dr. Robert Wilco, who will hold the new ICOR chair at NINT. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Capital Region Innovation Center, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Alberta Research Council, the University of Lethbridge, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. And welcome to our new sponsor, ICOR, the Informatics Circle for Research Excellence. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.